Your Financial Choices may discuss various financial-related topics and thus would like to offer the following disclosures. Lori Siebert is employed by Valley National Group, the Valley National Financial Advisors Group of Companies. Investments are offered through Valley National Investments Incorporated, member FINRA. We inform you that any federal tax, state tax, financial advice, or information contained in this communication is not intended to be personalized or specific in nature, or to be relied upon for your personal situation in any circumstance. The advice and information are not intended and cannot be used as a tax opinion letter, nor used for the purpose of avoiding tax-related penalties. For personalized advice specific to your own situation, we recommend that you consult your CPA, CFP, or attorney.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. I'm a CPA, CFP, and AEP on the web at yourfinancialchoices.com, and you can listen online each and every week at wdiy.org. Today is December 12th, 2018. The markets were up today, the Dow closing at 24,527, the NASDAQ at 7,098, and the S&P at 2,651. Our topic tonight is special situations in estate planning. We are live tonight. We'll take your questions. Lori C. is in the studio with us this evening. We'll answer your calls, take your information, and we ask you to mute your radio so you can hear us without the delay and we can talk without confusion. We do discuss general financial planning topics and not specific investments. And while I typically have a topic each week, you can still ask questions off topic and I will do my best to answer them. The number this evening for live on air calls, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, you can give your question to Lori and she'll write it down and bring it in to the studio. But that is the same phone number at 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. Email is also available at yourfinancialchoices.com. I have a guest this evening to help discuss this interesting topic, attorney Dennis Pappas of Vassiliadis Pappas Associates, LLC. Dennis practices exclusively in the areas of elder law, trust and estate planning, trust and estate administration, special needs planning, and veterans pension benefits planning. He's admitted to practice law in Pennsylvania and New Jersey. He's a graduate of the Temple University Beasley School of Law and received his undergraduate degree in political science from Temple in 2001. Mr. Pappas is a VA accredited attorney for the preparation, presentation, and prosecution of claims for veterans benefits before the Department of Veterans Affairs. He frequently lectures and teaches and is a frequent guest of ours. Welcome back to the show, Dennis.
Thanks for having me again, Lori. Great to be back.
You're a great teacher, and that's what this show is all about, educating our audience. And we've touched on a number of topics, I would say probably more the standard fare that people are used to listening to. We talked about the four core elements of estate planning. We did that one time, and I've had a number of different topics. If people are interested in listening to those shows, they are available at wdiy.org. You just go to local programming, look for Your Financial Choices, and scroll through the topics that are available. But tonight we thought we'd mix it up a little bit because it's not always the same standard fare. And in fact, we would like our clients to know that they are never the standard fare. Everyone has their own situation. Don't you agree?
Everybody is special, and we all have our unique circumstances. And I know you and I, especially as doing the planning and the nuts and bolts, we like it when everybody has some character to their estate plan. And it makes life a lot more fun.
That's a good way to put it as well, and so important that people understand it's not always what the neighbor has. So we're going to talk about, though, a few things that are a little out of the ordinary tonight. So when we talk about special situations, I thought maybe we could touch on several subjects. And because you are, you know, I know attorneys can't use the term probably expert, but you certainly understand veterans benefits. And that can be considered part of estate planning. When Dennis and I talked before the show, estate planning isn't just about having a will, folks. Estate planning is also about that life planning you have to do to make sure your assets or your estate last your lifetime for your needs. So we're going to talk a little bit about veterans benefits, ancillary probate. We're going to talk about what that means. Just touch a tiny bit on something when we have foreigners or non-domestic estates. I'm getting more frequent questions on the show about having relatives in foreign countries, but folks live here and they kind of sometimes wonder what that means. Talking about filing a federal estate tax return, what are the new exclusion amounts? When might we file one, even if we don't have those assets? And if we have time, we'll hit on something called intestate estates. So sometimes people don't know those words or what they mean. So, Dennis, do you think that sounds good?
I think that sounds great. I love these shows. You know, sometimes we come in and we have one topic, and we're going to go for an hour on this topic. And I like these special situations, as you put it, because we have these really cool things that you and I see in everyday life, but maybe it's not relevant to have a full hour on the show. Right. So it's kind of this potpourri of, hey, you know, we're just sitting at a bar, or we're having coffee, we're having a beer, and nerds like us are like, hey, Lori, did you see these new VA rules that changed? Or, hey, Dennis, did you see, you know, these new intestate things that happen? You know, say intestate, estate, 10 times fast.
And, yeah.
But we're dorks like that, so yeah. We're going to keep it simple and talk about some fun things that you brought up today. I think I'm excited.
So good. We'll do some high level discussions, understanding that, folks, this is educational, and Dennis loves teaching. I love teaching. So it's nice to bring this awareness to people. Dennis, just before we get started, you guys do have periodic webinars or seminars on various topics, one of them being veterans benefits, which we're going to talk about. But how do people find out information about those seminars?
So our seminars are going to start back up in January. We don't, the ones in December already occurred. Our website is www.lawvp.com, V as in Vasiliadis, P as in Pappas. And our telephone number is 610-694-9455.
Okay. And information on the various topics you guys run are on that website. Veterans benefits, let's start there.
Yeah, so veterans benefits is a huge area. The Department of Veterans Affairs, a federal program, offers many programs. Life insurance, educational benefits, healthcare benefits. I think unknown to many people, VA has the largest healthcare organization in the United States. Little tidbit that I don't think a lot of people know about. So the benefit that we want to talk about today that I think is germane because the laws recently changed is VA pension. As I mentioned before, people think about veterans benefits, they think about, was myself, was my dad, a parent, family member, were they injured in the service? And there is a VA benefit called compensation where if somebody was injured in combat, they can get a monthly check based on their disability. That is not the program that we're going to be talking about today. We're talking about a pension program which has nothing to do with any type of disability that was incurred during the service. You did have to have some active duty service. So you had to be during a period of war, World War II, Korea, Vietnam. You didn't have to be in combat, though. So you could have, for example, been working in the Pentagon during the Korean War period, and you would satisfy that component. This is a tax-free monthly benefit. It's eligible for certain wartime veterans and their surviving spouses. And as a simple example, a married veteran might be eligible for up to $2,169 a month, a single veteran up to $1,830 a month, and a surviving spouse, important, up to $1,176 a month. The profile of the client where I think this benefit is very helpful is typically for clients who are over 65 and those clients who have large amounts of monthly out-of-pocket medical expenses. So if you or a family member have $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 a month of out-of-pocket expenses that you're paying, what might that look like? Home health care aides coming into the house, a family member who's in a personal care home and you're paying $3,000, $4,000, $5,000 a month. So if you know somebody that a veteran or a surviving spouse of a veteran that has a lot of these high medical expenses, wouldn't it be great to be able to pull in $2,100 a month, $1,800 a month, and that's going to help them pay for those medical expenses and more slowly draw down on their assets. And that can make a big difference in the quality of care that somebody gets. The pension program, as recently as October 18th of this year, there were major changes that kind of came out of the blue. So we follow this stuff all the time, and this was really unexpected. What the rules really deal with, just some of the broad parameters, are number one, then your assets can generally not be more than $123,000. Now, that's not to say that if you have more than $123,000 of assets, you can still be eligible for the program, but you might need to sit down and talk to somebody about, is it appropriate for me to make gifts? Should I think about making transfers into a trust? What are certain legal and accounting things that we can do? What are some estate planning things that we can do to help make that person eligible?
Does that include the home?
The home is not counted in the $123,600. However, we need to do some planning because even though the house is not countable up front, what happens if that family member is living in a personal care home and the house is subsequently sold? Now that house has been converted to cash, which is a countable asset. One other major change that people should be aware of is under the old rules before August of 18th of this year, for clients who maybe were over the asset limit, they were able to make gifts or transfers, and there was no penalty, at least from the perspective of the VA. After October of 18th, what the VA has done is they say, we are having a 3-year look back. We will audit all applications made after October the 18th. And if we see that a client transferred assets, there are certain penalties that apply. We won't have time to talk to them about them today, but it's not a fine. It's not jail or anything like that. But generally what the VA is saying is if you gave away a certain amount of money, you're eligible for the VA benefits. We're just going to delay when you physically start getting the check. And it makes sense because what was happening under the old rules is people had more assets than the program limits allowed. They would give those assets, let's say, to their children or to a trust, and they would turn around and qualify for VA benefits. And I think it's reasonable where the VA says, wait a minute, you know, if you're just giving away hundreds of thousands of dollars, it's really not fair that you're qualifying for this program. And so not to be confused with Medicaid, for people who are in nursing homes, Medicaid has a 5-year look back. For VA purposes, VA says, you know what? We kind of like what Medicaid did. We kind of like how that federal program is administered. And they took certain things from the Medicaid side and they applied it to the VA side. So,
Dennis, I want to keep talking about this, but we're up to our break. And I was so enthralled with Dennis talking, I missed it. So we'll be back in just a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including fee-based asset management. It all starts with personal goals and an understanding of risk tolerance, investment objectives, and the markets. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
WDIY 88.1 offers many choices and real voices. Folk music, from folk classics to the Gaelic traditions of the British Isles, to bluegrass and old-time music of Appalachia, to the modern-day singer-songwriters telling the story of today's world. You'll find it all here on WDIY. Listen and enjoy the wide variety of folk music every weekday evening, 7 to 9 p.m., just after NPR News headlines, and Sunday mornings at 11 a.m. on 88.1 WDIY and streaming at WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. This is your host, Lori Siebert, and I have in the studio with me this evening attorney Dennis Pappas of Vassiliadis Pappas Associates, and we are discussing special situations in estate planning, and Dennis was talking about veterans benefits, which I want to ask him a couple questions about. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810, 610-758-8810. You could talk live on air with us, or if you're not comfortable talking live on air, give your question to Lori C. She'll write it down and bring it in to us. And we're covering a number of topics tonight, kind of broadly, but here I want to jump right into the details of this. Dennis, just let me clarify something. So you mentioned that there's this benefit, this VA benefit. You call it a pension benefit, but is it a disability benefit?
So it's not purely a disability benefit. It's not related, as we said, to any type of injury that was sustained during the military.
That's what I thought you had said.
But what you do want to look at is typically for our clients who are over 65 years old, you're looking for a high amount of unreimbursed medical expenses. So I guess in that respect, you typically have clients with a physical or cognitive disability. It has nothing to do with them being in the military.
Okay.
It's just somebody is 70 years old, they have dementia,
okay,
they're living in a personal care home, and their rent is $5,000 a month. That client may be served during the Korean War period. So what the VA says is, look, you're a veteran, you're in a personal care home, you have several thousand dollars a month of unreimbursed medical expenses. If you meet some of these asset tests, then you could be eligible for potentially, you know, $2,100 if you're married or $1,800 if you're single. So disability, yes, but not necessarily serve as connected disability.
Okay. And then also, because these veterans who may qualify for these benefits have a higher asset level than someone might have when we talk about Medicaid, which you barely can have any assets. So there's a higher asset level here, but to mitigate running those down, this is really a benefit that could help extend that the assets that are remaining a little bit longer.
Absolutely, because if you think about it, if you're getting about $2,169 a month, you're pulling in at least another $24,000 of tax-free money. So if you have somebody who's in personal care, that's going to help them prolong their assets. I use the example, I kind of call this middle-class long-term care insurance for veterans. What does long-term care insurance do? If you have long-term care insurance, it pays you a monthly benefit if you need medical services, if you need skilled nursing care. And so this is kind of, if you want to think about that, we're just bringing more income to help make that veteran or the surviving spouse. Mm-hmm. You know, typically it's the husband. Let's say the wife is the surviving spouse. The wife, typically women have a longer life expectancy. You know, getting another $1,100 a month can make a huge difference to making sure they're in a quality personal care home.
And they're not eligible for this if they don't have medical expenses. If they're just sitting in their own home, they're living the life and, you know, living.
Yeah, generally speaking, if you have a veteran or the surviving spouse who's living independently at home,
right,
you know, everything's hunky-dory. Just based on the income and the asset limits for this program, they're probably not going to qualify unless they have those medical expenses, which kind of the VA lets them use those medical expenses as a deduction. And that's what opens the door for these disabled and sick clients to get that benefit.
Okay.
So healthy clients will most likely not get this type of a benefit.
Okay. When they look at income sources, do they count Social Security?
Yes. Generally, okay. All income is countable in most cases.
Okay. So that's why it makes sense then that it's the Social Security or other pension income, but they're also looking at the expenses then.
Exactly.
And typically when they're running into these kinds of medical costs with long-term care or nursing care, that then you can make the case for this.
So that's why the demographic, the profile, if you're, you know, people are out there sitting at home or you're driving around, are you a family member or a friend generally over 65? And is it somebody that's starting to have every month out of pocket $1,000-$3,000 a month? We're not talking about somebody that has a health insurance premium, a Part D premium, and they have $50 in prescription meds. That's probably not going to work right now. We're looking for $1,000-$4,000 a month. And who are the people that have that? People that typically have home care coming in 2-3 times a week, 4 times a week. People that are in personal care paying $3,000-$5,000 a month. Those are the people that generally have enough medical expenses out of pocket to make this work.
Okay. And home care, does it count if it's someone, a caregiver who has to just kind of come in and help with housekeeping or food preparation?
Yeah,
when
generally not.
We talk about home care.
We're generally talking about a medical standard.
Okay, good.
And hopefully, if you're paying somebody under the table, it's probably not going to work because you're not going to be able to document that unreimbursed medical expense. So
right.
I know those issues come up.
This is great information. Do nursing facilities ask these questions? Nursing homes or assisted living?
Yeah, the
places?
Assisted living facilities do. And they actually, a lot of times they'll invite me to go speak because it's a great benefit for their clients. In a skilled nursing environment, when they're in a nursing home, the answer is generally no. And the reason for that is you usually can't get 2 scoops of ice cream from the federal government. So someone who's in a nursing home, our focus is usually on their Medicaid planning. Because if someone's in a nursing home and they get $1,000 or $2,000 a month from the VA, if the nursing home bill is $10,000, $12,000, $15,000 a month, that benefit is very small, whereas Medicaid would pay the entire cost of the bill. So our focus there is to try to get the Medicaid. And if you're on Medicaid, the VA law actually says you can't get your VA benefit if you're on Medicaid as a general matter.
Okay. And you guys do Medicaid planning as well, right?
Exactly.
So that's part of estate planning as well when people are concerned about running down the assets that people have, you know, accumulated over their life and to see it all go to nursing home.
You mentioned special situations at the beginning. Medicaid planning is one type of estate planning for people who have the special situation of what? Being in a nursing home or about to go into a nursing home. Veterans benefits planning is a type of estate planning for people that have the special situation of high medical expenses and that are veterans. You're probably getting ready to say special situations for people that have ancillary estates. How do we estate plan for that? So everybody's got, that's the characteristics of all this.
Yeah. Okay. Folks, we're coming up on our second break. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. That's 610-758-8810. When we come back, I want to ask Dennis about people who move out of the area. And even maybe those people who are moving into the area. I want to ask some questions about that before we move on to, as he mentioned, ancillary probate. So again, 610-758-8810. Back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including income tax preparation for individuals, businesses, estates, and trusts. Tax preparation involves more than putting numbers on a return. It requires planning. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
American folk music offers a variegated pattern of performers and styles. I'm Tom Druckenmiller, your host for In the Tradition. Together, we'll trace the roots and branches of American folk music from the earliest recordings and performers through today's talented players. In the Tradition, Wednesday evening from 7 to 9 p.m. on WDIY 88.1 FM and WDIY.org.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. I have in the studio with me this evening attorney Dennis Pappas of Vasiliadis Pappas Associates. We're discussing special situations in estate planning. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. You can also send questions through email at yourfinancialchoices.com. We're live, so you can talk live with us in the studio. If you're not comfortable talking live, you can give your question to Lori C. She'll write it down and bring it into us. Dennis, let's move on. Let's talk about some other issues. We quite often have clients who are living up here. You know, they're working lives, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. We get older. We don't like the cold so much. We start thinking of warmer climes. And, you know, we visit Florida for a month. Then we visit Florida for 3 months. And pretty soon we have clients who are moving to Florida. Sometimes they stay as snowbirds and then they have maybe, you know, two homes. And then we have to talk about where are they actually domiciled? Where are they living longer? Because we have to know their resident status for their tax returns. Tell me what happens with their estate planning documents and estate planning.
Sure. So we have this concept, and I think you mentioned it, called ancillary probate, fancy word. One of the things we need to talk about very quickly is what's probate in general. We've talked about this before, but generally speaking, when somebody passes away, whether there's a will or not, the executor or the closest living family members, they go to the register of wills in the county where that person was domiciled, and the executor gets empowered. And if there's a will, they accept the will. I mean, effectively, that's what probate means. There's a lot of bad information about there. Ancillary probate means you might have to do that twice. If you have your foot in two states, Pennsylvania and Florida in your example, you might have to probate in both states. So we call that an ancillary probate. You have to do it twice. Now, one of the first questions people say is, well, how do we avoid ancillary probate? I would say that the first question is, do we need to avoid ancillary probate? And here's what we mean by that. We've talked about this before where each state has its own probate laws. Some states, their probate laws are a little bit more complicated, time-consuming, and expensive. A state like California, a state like Florida, Texas.
Virginia, I think.
Perhaps New York, Virginia. Some states have much simpler probate laws. Pennsylvania, thankfully. New Jersey being another example. I recently had a case in North Carolina. Simple administration. So when we talk about avoiding probate, if it's a state with a simple probate process, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, let's say, I don't think we would do anything to avoid ancillary probate. So the simple example would be you have a Pennsylvania resident, and they have a shore home in New Jersey. What happens when that person dies is, in Pennsylvania, we're going to probate the will and the executor is going to have the authority. What happens in New Jersey? How is the Pennsylvania executor going to sell the New Jersey shore home? And that's where the New Jersey is going to say, well, wait a minute, we have to, Pennsylvania, accept you. We have to recognize that you have authority in New Jersey. Well, to do that in New Jersey, all as I would tell the executor to do is, we go to the courthouse here, we get what's called an exemplified copy. You get an official copy of all the PA paperwork, and we send it to New Jersey, whichever county the real estate's located. And that county says, oh, okay, we recognize you as the executor, and now you can sell the house and do the deed. That's pretty simple. So if I had that type of a client, there's not much additional planning that we probably would do, right, big picture, to avoid the probate. There's nothing really to avoid. Now, what if we had that Florida client? Pennsylvania resident, they have a house in New Jersey. Well, Florida probate laws are a little bit more complicated. And so we might say, you know what, we got to do some extra things. Maybe, for example, we're going to create a Pennsylvania revocable trust. We're going to take your Florida property and we're going to put it into the Pennsylvania trust. That way, when you pass away, we don't have to go through a full-blown probate proceeding in PA and in Florida. We'll have a kind of a mini probate in Florida, and now the real estate can be sold, and we could get along with the business of closing up the estate without having to do two full-blown probate estates. So the first question is, what are the two states we're talking about, or three states, or what states are involved? Are they hard probate states, or are they easy probate states? A revocable trust, we mentioned, is often a classic tool that we can use to minimize, if not altogether avoid, probate estate. Sometimes joint ownership might be a way to do that. So maybe you have, let's say there's a widower and he has an only child, an adult child who's a Pennsylvania resident. You know, maybe we put the Florida property in joint names with the adult son. That might be a way to minimize or avoid probate when the father dies. But now what happens when the son dies? So those are the considerations. Those are some of the things to think about. What I want people to be very careful about is, number one, it should not be automatic. You should not be doing high-end, complicated estate planning to avoid ancillary probate without an analysis of, do you even need all of that? Like I said, in a state like Jersey, you don't need to do very complicated planning.
Documents and putting retitling something into a trust might cost more as well.
Absolutely. Anytime you do additional legal work, might not be much more, but it certainly is going to be more work to, for example, do the trust. You're going to need an attorney in Florida, for example, to retitle the deed into the trust. Is it hard work? It's not. We do it all the time. It's just a matter of, is it appropriate for the client? Mm-hmm. If the client can get along driving a Ford as an everyday car, we don't want to sell them a Lamborghini. Mm. The attorneys will make the money, but that's really not appropriate for the client.
Well, let's talk for a minute about someone who has bought a second home or has decided to move to another state. They've lived in Pennsylvania their whole life. They have a will, power of attorney, health directives. It's all Pennsylvania. And they decide to move to Florida. How quickly do they need to update documents, change documents? Do they need to do that? Some people probably don't. So
you're right. Some people don't. Number one is, in that situation, if you do estate planning documents, let's say in Pennsylvania, and you move to Florida, your estate planning documents are valid. So your will is valid, your power of attorney is valid, your healthcare power of attorney is valid, your living will is valid. Under the Constitution, states at a federal level owe each other what's called full faith and credit. It's no different than if you signed a contract in Pennsylvania and you're in Florida, the contract's going to be honored. So your legal documents will be honored. You should, however, still have those legal documents reviewed by a reputable estate planning attorney in that state. Why? Because there might be differences in state law where you might need to make changes to those documents. I'll give you a simple example. In Pennsylvania, when somebody passes away, Pennsylvania has what's called an inheritance tax. And if you move to another state like Florida, there generally is not an inheritance tax. And so there might be state differences where you might have to tweak those documents. But at least you have the peace of mind of knowing that if you haven't gotten around to it yet and there's an emergency and something happens, your documents that were executed are still valid across state lines. But I definitely would get them reviewed because, again, each state has these peculiarities. Another thing I would mention along the lines of these peculiarities and also ancillary probate, Let's say you do move from PA to Florida. You don't have two estates. That's not your situation. You just move states. Well, if you're in an estate like Pennsylvania, where the probate laws are very easy, most, not all of our clients, but most of them probably just need a will, financial power of attorney, healthcare power of attorney, living will, those core four that we talked about last time. If you move to a state like California, Florida, New York, Texas, you might need some additional documents. In those states, it might be appropriate to have a revocable living trust to avoid the probate process altogether.
Right, because it's so painful.
Because it's so painful. And that's where you just want to make sure you're not getting sold a bill of goods.
Okay. That's a great summary. Folks, we are at the halfway point. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. Perhaps you have your own special situation. And have a question about that. The phone number is 610-758-8081. You can talk to us live on air or off air. Just give your question to Lori C. She'll write it down. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with attorney Dennis Pappas. Back in a moment.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services for more than 25 years, including estate planning and tax preparation, especially for Pennsylvania and New Jersey residents subject to state inheritance tax reporting. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
This is WDIY. It's 6:30. Your current temperature is 37. Tonight, you have light snow, mainly after 5 a.m., low around 27. Thursday, a chance of showers and snow, high near 37. Thursday night, patchy drizzle before 1 a.m., mostly cloudy with a low around 31. Friday is going to be mostly cloudy with the high near 46. Friday night, low around 40. Saturday, cloudy with the high near 50 degrees. Saturday night is going to be a chance of rain, mostly cloudy with a low around 36. And for your Sunday, partly sunny with a high near 45. Sunday night, mostly cloudy with a low around 31. Now back to your financial choices with Lori Seabird.
Thank you, Shondi. Welcome back to the show. I have with me this evening attorney Dennis Pappas of Vasiliadis Pappas Associates. We are discussing special situations in estate planning. We've covered some overview on veterans benefits and applying for those, as well as general estate planning around Medicaid planning, which is kind of similar, but not exactly the same as planning for some of these veterans benefits. We've talked about ancillary probate and what happens when folks move to another state. Documents are still valid, but there may be reasons to get them updated or at least reviewed. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810, and you can talk with us live on air or give your question to Lori C. and she'll write it down and bring it into us. So Dennis, moving around could be a good idea to have things reviewed by your attorney, but it's, I think, comforting to know that people have documents at least. Let's talk about, since we are talked about having documents, what happens if someone doesn't have documents? So let's do the intestate thing. I was going to wait till the end to do that, but let's throw in the when we say people have documents, it's testate. So we've moved to Florida or we've moved wherever and we don't have documents at all.
So we have an intestate situation. So, you know, we have these technical terms and it's a mouth bender, intestate estates. First of all, the word testate means that somebody passed away with a will. So if you have a will, you passed away testate, T-E-S-T-A-T-E. And typically you have a will. In most cases, it names an executor. The executor goes to the courthouse in the county where the person passed away. They lodge the original will. It's accepted as the valid original will. And the executor is given what's called a short certificate, a fancy letter, right, with the seal on it that says, we, the court, recognize you, Lori, you have the authority of the executor. Go forth and conquer and take care of administering the estate. Somebody passes away without a will, or perhaps the will is invalidated. That's an intestate estate. That means somebody doesn't have a will. Well, so what happens? First of all, in an intestate situation, we don't have an executor. We have somebody called an administrator. Now, in the real world, it's really a distinction without much difference. So for the listening audience, whether it's an administrator or an executor, it's effectively the same thing. But that's kind of a key, a flag that, hey, wait a minute, this person's an administrator, not an executor. There wasn't a will. Now, who can be an administrator? If there's no will, who can be the administrator? What the law says is that there is an order of priority that's essentially based on blood relationships. So if a spouse dies, a surviving spouse is generally the first person in line, if they want the job, to be the administrator, followed by children, a decedent's parents, somebody that died, if let's say they didn't have a spouse, if their parents are alive, the parents could step in. So there's a pecking order. And whoever those qualified people are, they can go into court. They go to the Register of Wills, excuse me. It's a clerical office. And they say, look, my family member passed away without a will. Here's who I am. And I would like to qualify to be the administrator. They get a short certificate that says they're the administrator. Now, that's who can take care of paying the bills, collecting the assets. Who are we going to give what's left over after that? Who are the beneficiaries? Again, the law has a pecking order. What's the common thing that we get from our clients? I always like to ask our clients, right? I say, you know, dear Lori, you're my client. If you die without a will, who gets your money? What do most people say?
Spouse.
Spouse is one. I get government a lot.
The government gets all of my money.
Everyone you have smarter thinks, clients than,
everyone thinks
than I
the
do.
Spouse automatically gets everything.
And in most cases, it's going to go by blood relationships. So the spouse will get the inheritance. If there's children, the spouse and the children, and so forth and so on. You know, you don't have a spouse.
That's the piece people miss. Sometimes the children are going to get something. It's not always all to the spouse.
So if there's a spouse and children, what happens? One half generally to the spouse, and surprise, one half generally to the children. The surviving spouse is usually in shock when you tell them that. So there, the bottom line is there's this safety net for intestate situations where somebody dies without a will. Now, when I explain that to clients, what do they always say? Well, then why do I need you? Why do I have to pay you? And why do I need a will? Well, because the intestate situation doesn't cover all of the unexpected special situations that happen in estate planning. Very quickly, what are some of those other special situations? What happens if you have a disabled child? You don't want to give an inheritance directly to a disabled child. We usually create a special needs trust. Well, you want to create that in your will. So you don't want to default and say, well, I'm going to die without a will, because that will not take care of your special needs child. What happens if you have minor children? If you have minor children under 18, they're legally not allowed to directly inherit. And so, and I've had this situation, we're going to have to trek into court and say, dear judge, can you please create a trust for this minor child? And it creates all this additional time and expense when if you just had a simple will that says the inheritance will be held by my executor until the child is 21, you would have avoided that. So minority, disability, what happens if you have children who are in a rocky marriage? If it's an intestate situation and that child gets an inheritance and then they get divorced, rut-row, I got a problem. Whereas if you would have created a pretty simple trust, a discretionary support trust for that child. So although those special situations are specifically why you want to sit down and talk to the estate planning attorney, and hopefully your accountant and financial advisor are intimately involved in that, so you can make sure you're not missing all of these special situations. So intestate estate, that's generally the scoop on that.
And there are sometimes people who don't have wills, but they also don't have any assets. So there might not be the need to go in and do kind of an administration on it.
I have yet to meet somebody who's died with nothing. And in fact, those smaller cases are more difficult because someone always has a bank account. Mm-hmm. Someone always has a car.
I was just going to say
right?
a car. Yeah, so, life insurance through work, a lot of times people don't even realize that they might have a group policy.
And what didn't they do to that life insurance policy?
Put a beneficiary on it.
And then what happens?
Yeah, then it goes intestate through the
state. In most cases. Yeah. So, you know, what I always tell people, I think the bigger estates are a little bit easier to deal with than the small estates, because a lot of times in the small estates, who's going to want to deal with going to the courthouse, working with the lawyer, the accountant for somebody who's got $300 in the bank, a car, a little bit of credit card debt? Those cases are a lot messier.
So, yeah. So that's another special situation. Let's go from intestate, not having documents. We were talking earlier about the people who have maybe two homes and a number of states, maybe three homes or four homes. Maybe they just have a lot of assets. Let's talk for a minute about a federal estate tax return. So many people think automatically that there's this federal estate tax return. It only applies to rich people, doesn't apply to me. Let's talk about the exclusion, who's responsible for filing a federal estate tax return, and why might we file one? even if we don't have the assets.
Yeah. What's the general rule on this federal estate tax thing, right? When somebody dies, most people come in and they say, oh my God, the government's going to take all this money. And the big thing that we tell clients is there's generally two groups of taxes. This is Pennsylvania now, right? Mm-hmm. On the federal side, someone who's a Pennsylvania resident, if they die, what does the federal government say? I know you know this already, Lori, but the federal government says if you die and you have $11.18 million or more,
if you're married,
Uncle Sam, if you're married, they each get 11.18, right? So you know this stuff. You get $11.18 million per spouse. So when somebody dies, Uncle Sam says, you're a failure if you don't have more than $11.18 million and we're not going to tax your estate. I mean, that's right, mm-hmm. tongue in cheek. Mm-hmm. You're a loser. You don't have more than $11.18 million. If you have more than $11.18 million, you do start paying some heavy duty tax for every dollar over that limit. You're going to be in the 40 plus percentage for every dollar over $11.18 million. Well, guess what? What about the 99.9% of us out here, I'm including myself, that do not have $11.18 million. Uncle Sam says, nope, we don't care about you. Well, that's good. We don't have to worry about Uncle Sam. So we don't have to worry about the federal estate tax when we die. Most people don't. What does Pennsylvania say? Pennsylvania says, I don't care how much money you have. I don't care if you have $1. What Pennsylvania is saying is, we are taxing you, Lori, for the privilege of allowing you to give an inheritance to anybody that you choose. And the tax is based on who do you give the inheritance. If you leave an inheritance to your spouse, 0%. So there's no tax to spouses. If you leave anything to your children or grandchildren, the inheritance tax in Pennsylvania is 4.5%. If you leave an inheritance to your sibling, 12% tax. If you leave an inheritance to anybody else, nieces, nephews, friends, neighbor down the street, strangers, your favorite estate planning attorney, 15%. Now, the inheritance tax is that percentage based on the net after all the bills are paid. So we have a Pennsylvania inheritance tax and we have a federal estate tax. Okay. So going back to your initial question, the federal estate tax return is the 706 form, which the IRS gives us. Well, would anybody have to file the 706 form if they didn't have more than $11.18 million? And the answer to that question is maybe. And we have this concept of portability. What the heck? What does this mean? What this means is if we have a married couple and the first spouse dies and they don't have $11.18 million, okay, Uncle Sam's not going to bother them.
They might have $1 million.
They have $1 million. Now what happens though? What is that deceased, the first spouse that died, what do they have? They have a chip in their pocket. It's like a casino chip, right? And it's worth what? $11.18 million. They never cashed that chip. And so what we then say to the surviving spouse who is sitting in the office, we're saying, you know what? Is it worth taking that chip out of your deceased spouse's name and moving it over into your name? Portability, to move that unused chip. Now, why would we do that? Well, if the first spouse had $1 million and the surviving spouse has $1 million, are either of them ever going to have to pay the federal estate tax?
Only if they win the lottery.
Or they get a lawsuit.
Right.
Or they get an unexpected inheritance. Mm-hmm. Or for some reason out of the blue, they get so much money that when the second spouse dies, they have $11.18 million. So what do we tell them? We say, look, if you're really worried that something crazy like that is going to happen, we need to file the 706 when the first spouse dies. That allows you to claim the first spouse's $11.18 million chip. You will also have your $11.18 million chip. So you're going to have two chips in your pocket. So as long as you don't have more than $23 million when you die, you're not going to have to worry about the tax. The problem is what? You have to file the 706 after the first spouse dies in order to claim that chip. Well, what's the conversation that we have with many of our clients? If you have somebody who's not remotely close to $11.81 million, you're going to say, look, do you want to pay the accountant? Do you want to pay the attorney to file the 706 tax return? Which it's not necessarily cheap. It's a little bit of an involved tax return. In the off chance that you hit the lottery, get an inheritance, whatever. And what do most of our clients say? No,
no.
You know, I'm not going to file it. Now, what do you do though? This is lawyer speak right now. What do you do as the professional to cover yourself? We have a simple letter that says, I, the surviving spouse, the attorney explained it to me. I'm not worried about some unexplained situation. I'm not going to file the 706. And you tuck that away in your file so that way your neighborhood estate planning attorney like me doesn't get sued. But you have to, what's the bottom line? You have to have that conversation with the client, right? And the client's going to say, Dennis, why are you telling me all this? I don't have $11.18 million, let alone $23 million.
Well, one thing that we have to understand as well is that we are under tax reform right now, which had upped that exemption to, I just basically say 11.18, and it's set to increase with inflation, I believe.
11.4.
So let's say that. And but with tax reform sunsetting in 2025, back in 2026, we'll be back to the $5.5 million or whatever it might be. So there might be a window for those people who might be in that category that they would want to file as well. Right?
Exactly. Yeah, you're right.
So people just kind of have to be aware and make sure they're having those conversations with their attorneys if they might be exposed. And for all we know, the federal estate tax could go away someday, or it could go back down to lower amounts than, you know, what we had pre-tax reform. We just don't know. So
that's why I think the conversation's important, because everybody has a different appetite, right? I mean, you might have a client, you know these clients, right? They come in and they're just optimistic, and maybe they don't have a lot of assets, and they say, Dennis, I'm not going to pay for the 706. I understand all the risks. Thank you very much. But you have clients in the $2-5 million range that say, you know what? We're probably not going to have this issue, but you know what? I'm a planning person. I have my long-term care insurance, and I meet with my accountant quarterly. I meet with my financial advisor, and you know what? I am going to pay. I want the 706 filed because you know what? It makes me sleep better at night. And that's okay, because the client's making the choice. You and I are just giving them their options. I just want the clients to know their options.
Yeah, that's good. Folks, we're at our last break. If you have questions, the phone number is 610-758-8810. And we will return shortly with our guest, Attorney Dennis Pappas, back in a minute.
WDIY thanks its members and Valley National Financial Advisors, offering a broad spectrum of financial services, including portfolio management, tax return preparation, and financial planning for the accumulation years, retirement years, and estate distribution. On the web at valleynationalgroup.com or 610-868-9000.
Not only is becoming a WDIY member a great way to support the programs you love, it has its benefits. WDIY members have access to our weekly member ticket giveaway emails, discover great concerts, theater performances, film screenings, and more, all while supporting the many choices and real voices on WDIY. Make your gift today at 610-694-8100 extension 7 or wdiy.org. Thank you.
Welcome back to the show. This is your host, Lori Siebert. You're listening to Your Financial Choices. And I have in the studio with me this evening, Attorney Dennis Pappas of Vassiliadis Pappas Associates. I just want to remind folks, too, that we have podcasts of prior shows on WDIY.org. And if you're interested in hearing more about what Dennis has to say about estates, we've covered a number of different topics, the core elements, et cetera, of estate planning. And those are available under local programming, Your Financial Choices, and just search for the topic that you are interested in. We have a caller, Shandi, if you want to put us it through. We have Richard. Richard, hi, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Lori.
Hi, how can we help you?
Okay, I just had a question. Just as far as somebody, if you're have a modest home and your equity is you more or less own the house, it seems to be that a lot of times people, if they are going to move to another area, they might buy another home with all the attendant responsibilities that includes.
Uh-huh.
Utilities, maintenance, taxes, et cetera. And I'm just wondering if a person would decide, I'm going to sell and I'll use the equity, my sales out of that, to get a rental, and kind of cut into, it would be a shrinking. You'd be probably losing money depending on, you know, your retirement streams, income streams. But if there's any, from your point of view or Dennis's point of view, if there's any kind of negative stories that they've heard about that where people don't flip to another house, but they actually go into a rental position.
Okay. Yeah, so you have owned a home, you decide to sell it in your retirement, the maintenance maybe has become too much, and you decide to rent. First, when you sell your home, as long as you lived in it two out of the last, lived and owned it two out of the last 5 years, and your gain isn't more than $250,000 for a single person or $500,000 for a married person, then you're at least not paying any capital gains on that sale. So that's a plus. There's no, you know, problem there. So now you take your proceeds and you decide to just rent. I would say the only thing I would caution people about that is when you get the payday of selling your home and then you take those proceeds and either park them in the bank or invest them, you aren't tempted to go on a shopping spree or aren't tempted to keep them in cash, and therefore it's not earning any value for you, so that it's just kind of sitting there while your rent may continue to go up. So you may not be able to keep up with inflation or the ongoing living expenses you might have in a rental property. But on the flip side of that, if you invest it and think, well, good, I'm going to take the money out of my house, I'm going to invest it, and that's going to, you know, pay me the rest of my life. You have to understand that there's volatility and you want to make sure that you don't put all your eggs in one basket and that kind of thing. As far as adjust the kind of the cost of renting, I think it's a personal situation and a personal story. Sometimes I've had people who live in homes that the maintenance on the home is so much that they're paying to cut down trees that have been in the yard for 40 years, and it's thousands and thousands of dollars either in taking the trees down or damage that might not be covered by insurance because you weren't taking care of those trees, or other liabilities that may surround the property if you weren't able to maintain the maintenance simply by age or resources to maintain your property. So a rental, I wouldn't say I've heard bad stories. I would just say you'd have to be cautious of what you do with the money from the proceeds of your home. Dennis, do you have anything to add to that?
I generally would agree that I think the result depends on the client. Right. I've seen great situations and I've heard not so great situations. And there's really no rhyme or reason. It just, you know, depends on the facts of each case. Got definitely have to be careful on the rate of return on your investment. Even if you do something, quote unquote, conservative and you say, I'm going to stick it in the bank in a CD, you know, if the interest rates go very low and you are anticipating getting a certain rate of return, that could be problematic. Also, if you're moving into a rental, one thing I would be very careful of is depending on where you move into, if there's HOA fees. So if it's like a community, those fees can get very expensive. And, you know, unfortunately, I see situations where they rise quickly and the clients don't realize that, you know, until it's too late. So be careful with things like HOA fees. I think those are probably the main things. The thing that I tell my clients is when they say, I'm thinking about selling the house, I ask them why. And you mentioned, Lori, right, if you're downsizing because you can't keep up on the maintenance, if the expenses are just getting too much, you know, those are certainly valid reasons. If you're trying to do it for some estate planning reason, or I'm going to save these taxes, or it's going to make the administration of my estate easier for my heirs, I probably would say, you know, don't worry about that stuff. That's not a good enough problem in my eyes to warrant selling the house. So I guess fundamentally it's, why are you selling it?
Yeah. Okay, Richard.
That's a good question.
Does that help, Richard? Okay. I think Richard might have hung up. So we hope that helps. Dennis, to tag on to that point, though, sometimes with if you're doing some long-term care planning, if you do sell the home thinking, oh, you know, I want assets available, you could actually wipe them out in nursing home, whereas if you had the house, it would be preserved to some respect, at least during your lifetime.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. The other thing I would, and it's a similar question with the little twist, is I have clients who are thinking about moving into continuing care retirement communities where, you know, they might buy in and move into the independent living, and then they're guaranteed the spectrum of care through personal care, assisted living, skilled nursing. And I tell people to be very careful with that, again, because a couple things are, number one is, what type of personality do you have? I've seen it with husband and wife. One spouse really wants to move in. The other one's kind of lukewarm. They're living in the community. The purpose of those communities is for you to be active, right? And take part in the activities that, that the community puts on. And, you know, one spouse passes away now, and the surviving spouse is like, you know, I wish I was just at home. I just want to watch TV. I'm not into all this stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, that's something to definitely think about. I'm not saying that the continuing care retirement communities are bad, but that's kind of a special situation for people who are in a certain part of their estate plan. You know, probably people who are on the back end of their long-term care planning. And, you know, a lot of times we get asked, can you review the continuing care retirement contracts? What happens if I want to move back out? Do I get any of my money? What are the refund options? So a lot of that, there's a whole, that's another niche area of estate planning is selling the house and these communities.
Okay. We still have about 5 minutes left. So if we could talk for a minute about, we were talking about, I just wanted to thank Richard for his call. Thank you, Richard.
Thanks, Richard.
So we talked about, on one spectrum, the big estates and federal estate tax issues. Let's talk on the other spectrum. Someone might die with no assets or very little assets, and their debts exceed the amount of assets that they have.
Yeah, these insolvent estate situations, or where it's even close. We're not sure. Maybe the bills are close to whatever the equity of the estate is. I have a friend, a fellow attorney. His name is Eric Strauss. Mm. He's here in the Valley, and he does a lot of continuing education on insolvent estates. And I know sometimes he's like, I've been pigeonholed into these insolvent estates. So, Eric, if you're listening, I'm thinking about you. But what I tell people is, when somebody passes away, and a lot of times it's, I'm having this conversation with the kids. I say, be careful. Do not rush out to the register of wills. Do not probate the will. Don't get the short certificates, because a lot of times the natural inclination of the kids is, well, I have to probate the will. I have to get the short certificates. I'm automatically the executor. And I say, no, you're not. And the worst thing that you could do is go probate the will and the debts exceed the money. Why? Because number one, it's very hard once you're appointed as the executor to get off. You need court approval. And imagine you going to the judge and say, yeah, I opened the estate because I thought I was going to get some money. But once I found out I'm not getting any money, I don't want to be the executor anymore. And they're not just going to let you go. So it's, sometimes once you're in, it's a little tough to get out. The other thing, number two, is how are things going to get paid? And so you might have, you know, a well-meaning child starts to pay creditors. That's a huge problem, because you have to pay creditors in order. Not all creditors are created equal. So if you paid an unsecured credit card claim before you pay the final medical bill, you could be personally liable. I tell executors that if something goes wrong, you miss a tax deadline, you pay a creditor out of order, you don't distribute any money that's left over in the right way, the executor is personally liable. That creditor can come back and say, I'm suing you, the executor, because you screwed up. And so some of the conversations I have and the advice that I give, I say, you know what, child? Dad had a house. There was a mortgage on the property. The mortgage is more than what the house is worth. Dad had a bank account with $10,000 in it. There's $15,000 of credit card bills. I might say, walk away. Do not probate that estate. The creditors can then go into court, and they can ask the court to try to figure it out amongst themselves, but you have nothing to gain by probating the will in an insolvent estate like that. So if you're in that situation where somebody passed away, you think you're the executor or family member, and you have a will, and you're thinking, oh, the bank told me I got to rush out to the courthouse to get these short certificates, sit down with the reputable estate planning attorney to make sure if you should probate that estate. That could be a very, very dangerous situation. So, Eric, if you're there, insolvent estates, I'm thinking about you.
Because he teaches it. Very good, Dennis. Real quick, I just wanted to add one little thing, just because I mentioned I was going to cover it tonight. It's really too complicated. Just a little note for people who have maybe foreign relatives who are gifting from, you know, they pass away, they send over $200,000 to you. There are reporting requirements if you're a U.S. citizen receiving gifts in excess of $100,000, you have to report them. There's a form, a 3520. So be careful. Anybody who is either receiving inheritances from foreign persons, or if you are here making transfers to foreign persons, just be careful when you're looking at those kind of things. Or if you're someone who might be buying foreign real estate or investing foreign, there is all kinds of foreign transaction reporting that we must do. Huge penalties if we don't. So if you're getting involved in any of that, please take care.
What's the question, especially that we as planners need to ask up front? And I know you always ask it, and it's on our questionnaire. Don't assume that your client is a U.S. citizen. Don't assume your client is a resident, right? You always have to ask, because you would be shocked that quickly. I know we're up against it, but I recently had a husband and wife. The wife,
30 seconds.
Wife was from Northern Europe.
Yeah.
You know.
Yep.
I did not think that she was not a U.S. citizen until I saw it on her profile. Yeah, so always ask.
Gotta ask the question. Dennis, your website again?
lawvp.com.
Okay, and you can visit there to see some of the seminars that they are going to be putting on again in January, and for other information as well. Dennis, thank you so much for being on. We'll have you on in a few months again talking about another topic. Folks, if you have ideas for topics, you're welcome to send them to us at yourfinancialchoices.com. If you want to hear us talk some more about a particular estate planning topic, we'll bring Dennis back on to talk about that. Thanks, Shondi. Thanks, Lori. Thank you, listeners. Next week, my topic is gifting. How much, when, and how. Coming up next, we have Tom Druckenmiller with In the Tradition Folk Music. Remember, pay attention, be proactive, not reactive. Make the best of your financial choices, and have a great week.